The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh, perfectly portioned ingredients and step-by-step recipes so you can make incredible meals at home. Visit blueapron.com/takeaway to get your first 3 meals free.
Hi, this is The Takeaway. It's Thursday, September 22nd, 2016. If you like this podcast, subscribe on iTunes or anywhere you get your podcasts.
This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. Tear gas clouds and shining glass towers. The streets of Charlotte, North Carolina erupt.
We cannot tolerate violence. We cannot tolerate the destruction of property and will not tolerate the attacks toward our police officers that are occurring right now. And I feel very strongly about that. That is not the American way.
That's North Carolina Governor Pat McCrory telling CNN he's declared a state of emergency.
They started their push. Next thing you know, shots rang out. At first, it was the spray paint. The paintballs. Then they shot rubber bullets. Next thing you know, a real shot rang out.
We want to be able to walk the streets of our own neighborhoods that we pay good tax dollars for in peace, knowing that our children are going to come home safe.
We were like
knowing that our husbands
then.
Are going to come home safe. Knowing that we're going to come home safe.
Voices from the street yesterday in Charlotte, North Carolina. A police officer's fatal shooting of a reportedly armed African-American man, Keith Vallant Scott, on Tuesday, has spiraled into nights of violence. Last night, a man was shot and critically wounded during protests. Charlotte is the commercial hub of North Carolina and a regional economic powerhouse influencing North and South. It's home to both the Levine Museum of the New South and the NASCAR Hall of Fame. There are two pro sports teams here. But Charlotte and North Carolina are known lately for the controversial bathroom bill, HB2. Brenda Tendell is a historian and senior vice president of exhibits and education at the Levine Museum of the New South. She grew up in Charlotte, North Carolina.
This also happens on the heels of what happened in Tulsa with Terrence Crutcher. And, of course, a combination of events, including 3 years ago, the police-involved shooting of Jonathan Ferrell. Schools are in a bit of a conundrum in terms of the resegregation of schools, voting rights. It's an election season. We've been deeply involved in the discourses related to HB2. So it's a combination of issues that are happening at the local level, but also on the national stage as well. And so I would argue that it's a conspiring of local and national issues that have led us to this very difficult moment in our city.
Reminding people, HB2, of course, was the law that was passed that restricted people of transgender identity from using bathrooms of their own choice, a law that came from a very conservative group in North Carolina. Would you say that Charlotte sits sort of right on this divide? It's a very diverse city, but it is in a very, very conservative state.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think HB2 has been subsumed in many ways in the issue of sort of bathrooms. And bathrooms are but one component of a much larger, I would argue, civil rights issue as it relates to HB2.
Would you say that the state is going backwards on civil rights and that that's the perception of some of the people in the streets? Certainly you have these riots in the midst of glass towers and high-end shopping malls and people who really, really feel as though this is not their city. That's the impression you get looking at what's going on the street.
I would argue what's happening in Charlotte is not unique. I think what we've seen across the nation has been a frustration that is deeply informed by what's happening across the country. And so I think Charlotte is part of a much larger sort of national outcry for justice, for civil rights, for equity, for wanting to be seen, certain demographics wanting to be seen as human beings and wanting to be treated as such.
So you would say that not so much the changes in Charlotte over the last few decades have raised these voices. But you find that Charlotte is the voice of urban America rising up in a very conservative state, not unlike Ann Arbor in Michigan, Detroit in Michigan, and other cities, Austin, Texas, for instance, in Texas, where the politics are very, very different within the city and very conservative statewide. Is that what you're saying?
Absolutely. I also think that this isn't happening in a vacuum. That is to say that this isn't the first time that Charlotte has had to confront some really difficult issues at the intersection of complicated matters at the city level. So, for instance, in 1997, a very similar social and political climate in Charlotte was evident. There were a number of incidences, including police-involved shootings, the prospect of public schools resegregating, and really an influx or an increase in ethnic and regional diversity in the city that led to some tumult. And so in that regard, what's happening in 2016 was also happening in 1997. And so this isn't a new wave of disconcertedness among or concern among our community. We've seen this before. So, yeah, this is something that is evident on a national stage. But again, Charlotte is not immune from these episodes of discontent.
African-Americans make up about a third of the population of Charlotte. The chief of police in Charlotte is an African-American. Why is there such a difficulty among the police leadership in reaching the demonstrators?
Wow. I mean, I think that's a really good question. And we also shouldn't assume that the protesters are a racially monolithic. What I saw last night when I was I actually attended the protests at Marshall Park that ended up leading to the Little Rock AME Zion Church. And from there, there were a group of protesters that sort of defected from what was a planned peaceful protest. It was a very diverse demographic. And so in many ways, as much as police-involved shootings have a racialized contour, I think it transcends race. I think nationally and certainly locally, we have some issues with community engagement and policing. And so I think the issue is far more nuanced than the racialized dynamics that certainly inform the relationship between police and the communities that they are supposed to serve.
You're senior vice president of exhibits and education at the Levine Museum of the New South in Charlotte. It sounds to me like in many ways the leadership is really not prepared for the kinds of voices that they are hearing, regardless of race, that the scale of this has taken the authorities in Charlotte on many levels by surprise. Would you agree with that?
I definitely think the kinds of sort of protesting that has taken place in Charlotte may be not as familiar to our city. While we've dealt with issues, as I suggested in 1997, that very, very much mimic what is happening right now, the kinds of responses that we're seeing from the community is indeed, I think, new in some ways. And so, for instance, when Carrick trial, as it relates to the Jonathan Ferrell case, the officer involved in his shooting, when he was acquitted, we did not see the kinds of spasm of rioting and protests at that time that we're seeing right now. And so it certainly could be the case that we weren't nearly as prepared for this kind of reaction or response from our community.
How would you say, before we go, that the success of Charlotte has brought with it some of these demands for equality and racial and economic justice, if that is indeed the case?
I think I would agree with our mayor, who in the press conference on yesterday morning, she really illuminated the way in which Charlotte has a legacy of being a very cooperative place in terms of its civic and business and community sectors. And so that has, in many ways, allowed Charlotte to face difficult moments with robust community engagement and cooperation. I feel very confident that even in light of these very difficult moments, that we will marshal that same kind of energy and approach to address our current situation.
Would you say Governor McCrory has credibility on the streets of Charlotte this week?
I would say that these are challenging times for our governor, for sure. And again, the combination of social and political issues shaping the state and Charlotte, I would argue, makes this a very difficult time for our governor, for sure.
Can you still smell tear gas this morning?
I did not smell tear gas, but I can tell you that Center City is a quiet place. It's much quieter. And I actually took a drive through University City, which was where the first night of protesting took place. And it was very quiet there as well. And for me, that is symbolic of our community really trying to process what is happening.
Brenda Tendall is a historian and senior vice president of exhibits and education at the Levine Museum of the New South in Charlotte, North Carolina. Thanks so much, Brenda.
Thank you.
I'm Elizabeth in Pineville, North Carolina, just south of Charlotte, North Carolina, and I've lived in the area for 13 years. I'm a little shocked, perplexed, and saddened by the riots that have happened over the last couple of days, and it's something that you think won't happen in your town until it does.
This is Frances Dawson from Cornelius, North Carolina. I'm sad that worthy, peaceful protest is usurped by those not inspired to effect change, but rather intent on promoting fear and anger. A useful message is lost in the headlines.
Incredibly frustrated, says someone from Charlotte, that these protests can't stay peaceful, especially in the absence of any footage showing what actually happened. It serves only to harm an incredibly important cause. I have a feeling this will end like all the other recent shootings, with little more than lip service or nominal changes paid to communities of color until the next black man dies at police hands under questionable circumstances.
I'm saddened by the hate that I see in so many social media posts. I'm fearful of the world that we're creating for our children. I'm shocked by the violence. I'm hopeful that we can come together as humans. And I'm ashamed that this makes me look at all people in terms of race or social class.
Another Charlotte resident, extremely frustrated both with inaccurate coverage of the protests and with authorities' refusal to release the video of Scott's death. We will continue to protest.
I'm calling from Charlotte. I am feeling scared, worried, and sad for my city. That people would come together instead of doing protests where they're using violence and fear. I've had friends have guns pulled on them now. I have a husband who has to drive through all of this to get to work and home. And I'm just hoping that it all ends soon.
Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or comment at thetakeaway.org.
Support for The Takeaway comes from Curious.com, committed to helping people build their CQ or Curious quotient through the game of lifelong learning. Curious, where people can learn something new every day at Curious.com/PRI and Staples. With copy and print solutions for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom framed prints and posters. More at Staples stores or Staples.com. Staples, make more happen.
Let me thank you in advance for voting in 2016, you more than 320 million Americans. Actually, I'm really speaking to the 240 million Americans over 18, or the 220 million eligible voters. But really, maybe it's only the 142 million or so who get around to becoming registered voters, and then just over half of them will actually show up. If this was Sweden, I would be talking to the 82% of the population that votes in national elections. We would rather be more like Sweden than like Djibouti with turnout in the 20s. But the lower the number of voters, the more the system is open to manipulation. The more a rush of voters here and there or a bunch who can't get to the polls over there can be very critical to the outcome. This is a built-in incentive to mess around with the process at the local level. Low turnout combined with the strangeness of the U.S. Electoral College system can reward a strategy that concentrates on a few regions and districts. It is the responsibility of the states to make the rules. States draw the districts for congressional races. They can consider voter ID laws, voting hours. They make the schedule for getting registered. David Daley is former editor-in-chief of Salon. His most recent book kind of hints at where he's coming from here. It's called Rat, well, I can't really say it on the air, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. Anyone can play this game, he says, but the Republicans have been winning all the medals lately.
The Republicans launched a really audacious plan after the 2008 election in order to take this process over, and it has been staggeringly effective over the course of the last several years. Republicans now run two-thirds of the nation's state legislatures, and those state legislatures draw the lines that make up our congressional districts. And what they managed to do, thanks to amazing new technology and a very gutsy political strategy, is to take gerrymandering, which had existed and been part of our political process, of course, going back to the very beginning, but turned it into sort of gerrymandering on steroids. The new data, the technology, and the ease and certainty with which it can be manipulated is what makes the post-2010 redistricting cycle fundamentally different from any other in the modern era, and we are living in a Republican majority because of that, even though they have a minority in most of these elections.
And what you're talking about here is a process that has made the House of Representatives very, very difficult to wrest from Republican hands. And you're also talking about keeping party out of this for a moment. You're talking about nationally based groups manipulating and interfering in the process or getting involved in the process of individual states where the Constitution says regulations on elections should be placed.
That is correct. A lot of Americans believe that 2008 was the truly essential election. Barack Obama, a supermajority of Democrats in the Senate, a Democratic majority in the House. Savvy Republican strategists understood that 2010 was actually much more important. Less turnout in that year, but it's a redistricting year because every 10 years we redraw all of these lines in state legislatures nationwide. Those bodies then go ahead and draw the national lines. Republicans and their big donors came up with $30 million, and they essentially targeted 107 seats in 16 states, knowing that if they could pull off those wins in those seats, small districts, all of that money makes a huge difference. It comes right after Citizens United unleashes floods of dark money into the system, that if they won those seats, they could control the drawing of district lines for 193 congressional seats across the country. They pulled it off, and the House is in solid Republican hands for the rest of the decade because of this, almost no matter what the vote. And at the same time, you have state legislatures that have also been gerrymandered in similar ways. So Ohio, North Carolina, Michigan, all kinds of bodies in these blue or purple states where a majority of the people vote Democratic, but you have solid red legislatures passing solid red laws.
Donald Trump says, watch out, this election could be stolen. It sounds like you're saying it already has been.
The system has been rigged in so many different ways, and we're not even talking about the real ways in which the election has been rigged. We accept gerrymandering as simply part of the process and the way that politics is done. We should be outraged at the fact that we are 50 days out from an election, and we can already know that the House of Representatives, supposedly the people's house, the chamber that is supposed to be most directly responsive to the will and whims of the voters, is out of reach of the voters at the ballot box.
But Donald Trump is safe in the sense that exactly what you describe affects Democrats far more than it affects a Republican running for national office, wouldn't you say?
Yes, I think that is absolutely the case. In 2012, the first election that were run on these new maps, Democrats got 1.4 million more votes than Republican House candidates. And Republicans still walked away with a 234-201 majority. That is very undemocratic. And what you have now is for the second presidential election in a row, The side that gets the most votes is not going to take control of the House. And the next president is going to have to work with a Republican House, even one that gets more than 1.5 million fewer votes.
Former editor-in-chief of Salon, David Daley's most recent book is Rat F***, the true story behind the secret plan to steal America's democracy. Thanks so much, David.
Thanks for having me, John.
The Takeaway is supported by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you all the ingredients you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come paired with an easy-to-follow recipe card delivered to your door weekly in a refrigerated box. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying specialty ingredients and exploring new flavors and cuisines. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free plus free shipping by visiting blueapron.com/takeaway.
Among the things voters failed to consider in the recent UK vote to leave the European Union was whither the Isle of Man. You might ask, do people in the UK under any circumstances consider whither the Isle of Man, nestled between Britain and Ireland? Well, the voters on the island have no choice. Citizens of the Isle of Man head to the polls today to choose the new leaders of their governing body, the Tynwald, as it's called. It's considered the world's oldest continuously sitting parliament, 1,000 years old. But the state is a crown dependency, not technically part of the United Kingdom, but in a political nether world that the Brexit vote made more nether than world. Alan Bell is the chief minister of the Tynwald. He will be stepping down after 32 years, but he agreed to help us understand the predicament his fellow citizens are now in.
The Isle of Man is not a sovereign state in its own right at the moment. We are what is called a crown dependency, which means that the UK has responsibility for our defence and our international matters. Other than that, the Isle of Man is internally self-governing. And the new relationship we have to negotiate with Europe has to be done through and with the UK government on our behalf. We can't do it directly ourselves. So the issue of greater sovereignty for the Isle of Man may well evolve over the next few years, depending on the progress or otherwise of the new relationship we develop with the outside world.
What a mess. I mean, you have to depend on UK negotiators. Why would you trust them? How can you trust them in this situation?
Well, this is the challenge for the Isle of Man, of course, because the UK government is still in some pretty tense negotiations with the remaining 27 countries of the European Union to establish its own long-term relationship. Then they have to negotiate a special arrangement for the Isle of Man after that. So it is going to be quite a challenge for the island to make sure that the UK stays focused on what we need as well as its own broader needs.
But it sounds like you don't need any lessons on governing from the UK. You've had the longest sitting parliament in the world. Is that true?
Yes, it's the oldest continuous democracy in the world. And it was established by the Vikings in 979. So we've been around for a little while. The UK boasts about being the mother of parliaments. And I think it's fair to say the Isle of Man government is the grandmother of parliaments.
What's the big issue on the Isle of Man? I mean, aside from this Brexit vote and this mess that the UK has put you in?
Well, Brexit will be a long-term challenge for the island. But alongside of that, because of the uncertainty generated by Brexit, we have to ensure that the economy stays strong, continues to grow, continues to diversify, and that we continue to attract the right level of skills into the island. Alongside of that, though, we have the same sort of challenges as many other countries. How do we sustain a long-term viable health service, because the Isle of Man has an almost identical welfare state to that enjoyed by the United Kingdom. How do we provide for education? In particular, how do we provide for long-term sustainability of our pensions, our state pension, and also our public sector worker pension?
I love that you have 16-year-olds voting. How do you go after the 16-year-old vote? Promise them free smartphones?
We have worked hard for the last few years now to educate our young people as to how democracy works, how important voting is for young people, how politics affect their daily lives. And I think this year we will probably see a higher turnout of younger people than we've had in the past. You might expect, you know, when we're dealing with 16, 17-year-olds, they often mature at different rates at that age. And some youngsters are very engaged with the political process, very active, very questioning. where others still struggle to see the benefit of it. So we continue through our education system to ensure that our young people are made as aware as possible as just how important election is and how it will affect their long-term lives.
Are you in semicircles in the Tynwald, and do you face each other on benches like in the House of Commons in London?
Yes, we do, but that's only for seating convenience. It's not because the Isle of Man doesn't have party politics. We're not divided in the chamber on party lines. We sit as to where our constituency allocation lies.
Alan Bell is the departing Chief Minister of Tynwald. He will step down after 32 years. Thanks so much.
My pleasure.
Support for The Takeaway comes from the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. The Takeaway's resilience reporting is supported by the Rockefeller Foundation. For more, go to rockfound.org.
That first ever parliament of the Isle of Man is a combination of opposing benches facing each other and semicircles facing a chairperson. Its parliamentary architecture may be kind of a trivia question wrapped in a trivia question, but it's one of the five styles found in all 193 UN member states. David Mulder van der Vecht and his architect partner Max Cohen de Lera first began thinking about how physical spaces can influence politics in 2010. Since then, the two have chronicled and examined the design of all UN member states, parliaments, and visited 15 parliaments around the world in an attempt to understand how architecture, the way politicians sit and face each other, the design of the room, affects the tone of political discussion. Their book, Parliament, is out this month, and David says it began with a question about Dutch politics.
This research in particular started in 2010 when we were watching television and they showed, coincidentally just after each other, two fragments of political debates. One was taking place in the Dutch House of Parliament that is organized in a semicircular shape with members of parliament in large revolving chairs. And the other debate was taking place in the British House of Commons that is organized with members of parliament sitting opposite each other in a very small space. And the kind of atmosphere between these two debates was totally different, whereas in the Dutch parliament there was a kind of a calm, a little bit boring atmosphere. The debate in the British House of Parliament was extremely intense and confrontational. And that made us think about the relationship between the space in which this debate takes place and, let's say, the kind of atmosphere of the debate. So in that sense, we could say that a parliament is, on one hand, the expression of a political culture, but at the same time, it also gives shape to that culture.
Well, there's a little bit of a chicken and egg issue here. I mean, is it possible that the Brits made a space that was perfectly suited for them screaming at each other?
You're right, in the sense that, of course, there is a relationship between, on one hand, the architecture, and on the other hand, what is taking place there. So you can imagine it's even like with smaller conversations you're having yourself, that the type of setting sort of affects the type of conversation. But the British House of Commons, for example, particularly dates back to the 12th century, to the nave of St. Stephen's Chapel, where the king was consulting noblemen, clergy, and other aristocracy. And that was, in fact, the first parliament. So it was not so much designed as a democratic space, interestingly, but as a royal court. And until today, still the setup of a royal court is the setup for the House of Commons. So I would argue that the House of Commons is, in fact, not so much of a democratic space, leave alone like a parliamentarian space.
That's fascinating. I mean, I love this history. I mean, you can go back to the Parthenon and the Acropolis and all of the models for democracy that relate to classical times. But how much variation did you find among the 193 member states that you studied and the 15 parliaments that you visited?
That was actually one of the shocking discoveries in the research. Although all these 193 parliaments think that they are a kind of unique expression of national identity, when you look beyond the immediate appearance, in fact, what you find is that there are only five typologies, as we call them in architectures, let's say archetypes. One is something we already talked about, the House of Commons, which are two rows of opposing benches. The second one is the semicircle that refers back to Roman and Greek antiquity, the theaters. Most parliaments in 19th century Europe are organized in this kind of semicircular setup. A third one is a sort of a hybrid between the opposing benches and the semicircle. So you have opposing benches that in one part of the room bend towards each other and start to form a horseshoe. A fourth one, which is more of a rare one, is a circle. And a fifth one is what we call a classroom, which is a room organized in long consecutive rows where all members of parliament are facing one speaker up front. And this typology is particularly popular among non-democratic regimes. So, for example, the room of Russian Duma, North Korea, China, they're all in this classroom setting.
That's so interesting. How does the U.S. fare? I mean, are we a standard archetype? Are we an exemplary architectural example of facilitating democracy? Or do you think the Capitol building gets in the way?
Well, I think, well, first of all, like the U.S. is organized in a semicircle, but in a rectangular space. That's kind of particular. Japan also has a sort of a similar setting. But I think what is more important is how most of these five typologies that I mentioned were invented in the 19th century and have hardly changed ever since. So while the world has changed tremendously, these parliaments are responding to that different world from a kind of 19th century interiors.
If you were to design a 21st century parliament which relied on the most advanced technology, would you invent a new typology or would you stick to one of the old ones? How do you think the future of democracy is going to require new thinking as far as architecture is concerned?
When thinking about a new parliament, you obviously also need to think about the culture in which that parliament is being placed. So it's difficult to speak about a parliament as sort of an abstract, perfect setting that works in any kind of context. But in general, I think there are a number of, let's say, themes you need to address when thinking about a parliament today. And one is, of course, media, like the public eye looking at parliaments in a much more omnipresent way than when parliaments were invented in the 19th century. And an important aspect of that is that people looking at parliaments need to be able to understand what's going on in a parliament. So one idea that I think is worth to sort of experiment with are parliaments in which the seating arrangement can be changed according to the type of debate. So, for example, for a more confrontational debate, a sort of opposing benches, as in the British House of Commons, would work perfectly well. Whereas for other debates where the aim is to try to foster consensus, a semicircular setting would probably be a better idea. Another element I think that is worth to consider is the increasing impact of particularly social media. Nowadays, members of parliament, at least in the Netherlands, are in direct contact with their electorate through, for example, Twitter or other forms of social media. And to think like how this feedback loop can be not in a sort of banal way by a Twitter fountain, but like on a more profound level, can have a more important role within also, let's say, how the debate is taking place within the room. Because in a way, architecture sets the stage for our lives. Politics is one of the domains architecture can also have an impact.
David Mulder van der Vet, thank you very much.
Thank you.
David Mulder van der Vet is the co-founder of the architectural firm XML. He's also the co-author of the book Parliament with his partner, Max Cohen-DeLara.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
And Staples. With copy and print solutions for small business, including color copies and presentations, booklets and manuals, and custom framed prints and posters. More at Staples stores or staples.com. Staples. Make more happen.
You know, in the time of the Renaissance, the issue of race as we experience it today was unknown. The city-states and feudal powers of Europe were becoming aware of the diversity of the world, from Asia to Spain and the Arctic to Africa. There was slavery back then, but it was an equal opportunity profession. All races could find themselves slaves. That's what makes the story of the so-called Black Prince of Florence so fascinating. He may have been the first person of color to ever become a head of state, but the skin color of Alessandro de' Medici, a Renaissance duke, was perhaps the least distinctive thing about him. He served in Florence for just 5 short years during the 16th century, from 1532 until 1537. He was illegitimate, his mother very likely a slave. The long-forgotten but compelling story of Alessandro de' Medici is told in a new book called The Black Prince of Florence. It's written by Catherine Fletcher, associate professor in history and heritage at Swansea University in the UK, Professor Fletcher says the story of Alessandro is both a treasure and a mystery.
I was trying to find a title that would convey both his role in the city, but also this extraordinary story that comes to some extent in his lifetime, but more importantly after his death, about his ethnicity and about the fact that his mother was said to be mixed race, Afro-European, and he, even within his own lifetime, was said to be the son of a slave. So I was trying to bring those two things together, but in his own lifetime, in fact, race doesn't loom as large as a story as we might expect today.
In fact, the notion of diversity in the Europe of the Renaissance is really unrecognizable to us. I mean, there was an understanding that people from all backgrounds were powerful, were part of society, were likely to show up at a port in Naples, for instance, or Florence, for that matter.
Yes, so inclusion in society is much more defined around religion and Christianity. So certainly if you have a Christian upbringing, if you are part of that society, then you can be accepted, particularly if you're from an aristocratic background. Now, that is not to say that Alessandro necessarily had it easy in terms of his own heritage. So he is very much attacked by enemies both outside and within the family because of his mother's status as a slave. But that is not so much connected to the colour of his skin. In fact, the people who were enslaved in Italy at this time, who were about 1-1.5% of the total population, they come from all over the place. They do come from West Africa, North Africa, but also from parts of what's now Russia.
His birth circumstances are much more irrelevant than any sense of ethnicity, is what you're saying.
Yes, that's right. That's really what we see coming out of the historical sources. People will say that he is unfit to rule a city of Florence on account of his mother being a slave, on account of the fact that he himself is illegitimate and therefore a proper member of the Medici family. But what they don't say is, well, he has dark skin, he has that dark curly hair, and therefore, on that basis, on the basis of his appearance, he's unfit to rule. That is something that comes into the later histories, particularly in the 19th century, when you have historians working in a climate of, scientific racism, trying to categorise people into races and give those races particular characteristics and a hierarchy. But you don't really see that in Alessandro's own time. That is something that really develops later on.
Did Alessandro have any vision for the Medici family that he led and the Florence that he was head of for even a short time?
What you see him start to do once he gets married, once he's quite settled in government and he thinks he's going to be there for the duration, he starts to build up a really spectacular court and cultural centre. And in fact, this is the court that his successor will indeed build, a court with artists, with the top musicians of the day, with beautiful furnishings for the palaces. He starts a project that again is carried through by the successor to move into the Palazzo Vecchio, the old historic palace in the centre of Florence, build apartments for himself there. So he really is the first person in this stage of the Medici family, when they're actually the dukes, the absolute rulers of the city, if you like, to start building up this very, very glamorous court society. But he's just not there long enough. He doesn't last long enough to really carry that through.
A very tawdry end, if you could describe it to us. Shall we
well,
go down that
end,
road?
Yeah. Well, it's not a spoiler, because I tell you this bit right at the beginning of the book, where Alessandro feared for his life. He had a lot of enemies, so he never usually went out without wearing body armour, these kind of reinforced doublets that they had in the day, reinforced with chainmail. But he was tempted to take his off by the prospect of an assignation with an attractive married woman. So he goes off to a chamber, waiting for this woman to arrive. And instead, a distant cousin arrives with an accomplice and they stab him to death in a very, very bloody murder. And the cousin not only murders him, but then he goes on to assassinate him really for a second time, if you like, by writing up the story of the murder and why he did it, and arguing that this was a blow for liberty because Alessandro was a tyrant and an illegitimate ruler of Florence. So it's a really dramatic tale, a very bloody end to his individual life, but some people would say that he deserved it.
Finally, if you look at the family tree in your book, the very elaborate family tree that you give to us all to mark the landscape of this very difficult to understand political time in Europe, it does seem that it was a small world. I mean, you could hold a family reunion and bring together a summit meeting of some of the great leaders of Europe. They were, you know, in some sense related to each other as well as being rivals.
Yeah, one of the real achievements of the Medici family in this period is to marry off different children to all the important powers in Europe. So Alessandro's half-sister, Catherine de' Medici, she's going to be a future Queen of France. And yes, it is a small world. Partly it's a problem for the Medici that it's a small world because actually they have lost a lot of their potential heirs in the family to death and disease, which is partly why Alessandro ends up being the person in power. But yes, it's extraordinary the way that this very small number of royal families all interact and all intermarry.
Any yearning to be a Medici and to inhabit those times, Catherine Fletcher?
It would be fascinating to go back for a quick time travel trip, but I don't think I'd want to stay there long term.
Catherine Fletcher is the author of The Black Prince of Florence. She's Associate Professor of History and Heritage at Swansea University in the UK. She spoke to us from our partner station WGBH in Boston. Thanks so much, Professor.
Thank you.
Here's something to take with you today. Proverbs 6, verses 6 to 8 says, "Go to the ant, thou sluggard, consider her ways and be wise." Researchers at the University of Scranton have taken this to heart in a very useful way and have chosen ants to be the subject in a study of the consequences of opioid addiction. The results have been written up in the Journal of Experimental Biology. The intent was to see how the social communities ants live in could be impaired or altered by opioid addiction. They discovered ants will choose drugs over food every time once given the choice, and that addicted ants do little else but seek out drugs. Other scientists wondered if there was anything really surprising about the ant reaction, but agreed this is a preliminary result and there was more work to do to consider her ways and perhaps even be wiser about all this. Subscribe to the Takeaway podcast, thou sluggard, on iTunes or your favorite podcast app, and be wise. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by TIAA. Whether it's investing, advice, banking, or retirement, TIAA is dedicated to helping those who teach, heal, and serve others achieve a lifetime of financial well-being. Learn more at TIAA.org.
And LegalZoom, dedicated to providing legal help to all Americans through online services, personal customer support, and legal advice through independent attorneys. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm David Remnick, host of the New Yorker Radio Hour. There's nothing like finding a story you can really sink into that lets you tune out the noise and focus on what matters. In print or here on the podcast, the New Yorker brings you thoughtfulness and depth and even humor that you can't find anywhere else. So please join me every week for the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.